Imagine for a minute working for years on a project as the lead on that project, only to have someone else take it to build a company around it. Now imagine having to sneak into a building at work at night to measure the floors because no one will believe you that your lab space is smaller, and it's a lot smaller than your male colleagues' labs. Imagine producing groundbreaking work in your scientific field, but being told that students won't take you seriously teaching them about that subject. Those are the true stories of women faculty at MIT, captured in Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Kate Zernike's new book, The Exceptions. And it wasn't until 1999 that the women in the science department started comparing notes and realized the full pattern of discrimination that they'd experienced and took action. Fast forward to today, the entire senior leadership team at MIT are now women. Kate Zernike joins us on the line to talk about The Exceptions. Kate, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, Kate, I want to start by, I read in preparing for this that you came into this story after noticing the way we do and don't talk about women in science, women as geniuses, women's contributions. Is that where this curiosity started for you?
Yeah, I mean, I broke the story for The Globe in 1999, and a year later I left to come to The New York Times, where I am now. But I always remembered this story, and I was reflecting on it in 2018 when, you know, the Me Too movement was surging, and I just thought, okay, that's an important contribution that, you know, the reminder that we can't have executives opening their back. But it just struck me that what these MIT women had talked about was in many ways a more pervasive and a more insidious problem, which is just that it's not a matter of, and it underlies the larger problem that we see even in Me Too, which is that it's not just about opening the door to women, it's about how you view them and how you treat them once they're hired. And so I think it really is just, that has been the hurdle for women in science, is they're just not seen as equals.
So what you did,
and so when we,
sorry,
yeah.
go.
No, I was going to say, so when you talk about, so I think we have the sense, I think the whole issue kind of crystallizes in science because we have this sense that to succeed in science, you have to be something of a genius. And, you know, studies have shown over years, like, genius is a word we apply to men. It's not a word we think of with women.
So now we've got these women in this book, and you bring several of them forward. Really, the first half of the book is bringing forward the lives and early experiences of several women who almost read like fictional characters, but are actually some still on faculty at MIT, and they win Nobel Prizes, and they lead major research initiatives, but they join the faculty at MIT. And by the way, you write very clearly that they are indicative of science departments around the country, not something unique to MIT. And they're just kind of squashed, including Nancy Hopkins.
Yeah, and that was, you know, that was what was really so striking to me. I knew I knew the broad strokes of this. I knew, as you said, that Nancy, when I did the story in 1999, I knew that Nancy had to measure the lab space, and I knew that they had lower salaries and things like that, things that I'd written about in the paper. But then to go back to their stories from the beginning and trace Nancy's evolution, she does not come at this, none of these women do, as activists or as feminists. They come to their jobs at MIT, a lot of them in the early 70s as affirmative action was just opening up positions to women, and they think they are so lucky to have these jobs. They're willing to put up, and they love doing science. They're passionate about it. So they're willing to put up with so much. And this ultimately, you know, I didn't know what I was going to call this book when I started, but I just kept hearing, first of all, women were always described as exceptional. But then these women, the way they talked about what happened to them, you know, it was always explained by, well, that was just that I was dealing with a difficult guy or a difficult person. And well, this was a personality conflict. And well, this was the situation at the time. They were explaining every sort of little hint of discrimination as the exception. And when you pile it up over time, I think when they all got together and compared notes, as you said, that's when they realized just the cumulative effect this was all happening, all having on them.
So let's bring forward Nancy Hopkins' voice. So backtrack. She falls in love with science. She takes a course from Jim Watson of Watson and Crick, gets involved in their work, Jim Watson's lab. She has a lot of different scientific areas of expertise over her career, but she tells a story. This is from the 2020 documentary Picture a Scientist. The first time she meets Francis Crick. And so here it is.
I was sitting at my desk in this little lab, which was adjacent to Jim's office. And The door flies open. I was in the room alone, and there's standing Francis Crick. He comes flying across the room, puts his hands on my chest and breast, and says, "What are you working on?" You know, looks at my notebook and says, "What are you working on?" And I was so startled, I didn't quite know what to say or do, so I sort of straightened up and said, "Oh, well, here, let me show you this. I'm doing this experiment somehow. I'm trying to do this." And at the time, the word sexual harassment didn't exist, wouldn't have crossed my mind.
It's a striking story, Kate, but not the least of which because it's one of many in like the 60s and 70s that the women at MIT in this faculty cohort experience.
Right. And I think what, you know, I tell that story in the book and then I tell what happens after, which is that Crick has come to Watson's lab in the, you know, this is 1964. It's a couple of weeks before Nancy's graduation from Radcliffe. And she's so excited to meet him and she's so excited to impress him with her intellect that she, when he does this story, comes up behind her and he puts his hands on her breasts. She is so worried about, her first thought is, "Oh God, how do I make this not uncomfortable for him?" She's not thinking about, "Oh, this was so uncomfortable for me." And then she goes, there's a party at Watson's house that night, and she goes, and it's just like this magical evening for her because she gets to stand in this small circle of people standing around Francis Crick and Jim Watson, and then they walk her back to her dorm that night. So this is just like, they were all just so, that science was really the driver for all of them. And so MIT hires them, and then they all get hired in the early 70s. And then by 1994, when these women all start to get together, when they all get together, they see that very few women have been hired since then. I mean, the percentage of women has just been flat since the early 70s. So they were all, I mean, you know, there were 15 of them. There were 194 men on the tenured faculty, 15 tenured women. And they were all working pretty much in isolation. So there wasn't anyone to share your story with. So one of the things I love about this book, I love sort of the, you know, I love tracing Nancy's history and the history of these women and how they all come together and they're all sort of like working in their own little area and then collectively come together. I love the history of Cambridge and the history of Harvard and MIT. But I guess what really strikes me is how much it took for all of this to come together. And it really is a story of collective action. So it's Nancy's story, really the, you know, as you say, the first two-thirds of the book. But at the end, the power of these women coming together is really something.
So I want to stay there just a little bit longer. We had an opportunity to speak with all three of the top senior women at MIT, all senior women leadership team, which really is given what we just heard. What we just heard Nancy say, and the fact that they didn't even start taking action on the notes they were comparing till 1999. That is striking. So this is Cynthia Barnhart, who's the MIT provost now, talking about Nancy.
There's great thanks among all of us at MIT now to Nancy and to the work that she did, because big changes did happen.
And she went on to talk about, reflect on the early 90s when she came. You just said 94, they start talking, they start realizing how few women are there. Here she is reflecting on her own experience in 1992.
When I started as a faculty member at MIT in 1992, one of the first meetings I was called to was a meeting of the women engineering faculty. We happened to fit in a conference room. We don't anymore.
So two things, and we're speaking with Kate Zernike, the New York Times reporter and author of The Exceptions. One, that's 92. They start comparing notes in 94. They don't actually start taking serious action until 1999, which means they've been living like this for 30 years. Two, the fact that they...
Well,
jump in there. Yeah, go.
No, I was just going to say, so they start gathering information in 1994. This is just the women in the School of Science. What Cynthia Barnhart is talking about is engineering, which is another interesting story that I'll get to in a second. But the men are sort of like, well, what's all this about? Like, the men sort of think like there's going to be this like separate hiring person for women, and they're really uncertain and they're a little bit scared. So it takes until 1995 for the women to get what they want, which is really pretty simple. It's just a committee to look at the whether there is disparity in the resources between men and women. They get that committee in 1995, and the dean of science begins correcting things. But really, the report doesn't come out until 1999 in March, and that's when I reported for the Globe. And it just took so much, but mostly it took was the president of MIT actually saying, we have discriminated against women on our faculty. This, he says, he has this great quote where he says, you know, I've always thought this was part perception, part reality. And what these women have made me realize is that reality is the greater part of the balance. And that was the huge, was why it resonated across the country and in some ways across the world for women in science.
It's also striking. You talked about reflecting on the Me Too movement in 2018. You talk about the power that happens when these women at MIT start gathering and comparing notes. It made me think about She Said by Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey, also New York Times reporters. They were here at one point talking about that book, and they talked about the power of getting all the women who had Me Too moments in the same room to compare notes and recognize a pattern. But that was just a few years ago. So have we made, I mean, of course we've made improvements. The entire senior leadership team of MIT is now women, but right. It is kind of striking the way history seems to be echoing.
Yeah, and that for me was the most amazing thing was at some point I you know, just because someone, an editor, one of my book editors asked me a question and I thought, oh, I should check that out. And so I went to the Schlesinger Library and got the 1964 Radcliffe yearbook. And it was really striking sort of, so that was, I think, the last yearbook that Radcliffe had alone. Because
And Nancy went to Radcliffe.
Nancy went to Radcliffe. Yes, yeah. It was her year of graduation. And the editors of the yearbook, just the way they talked about what their lives were going to be like and how they were going to combine career and family, and this was going to be fine. And this was just after Betty Friedan had come out with The Feminine Mystique. And they are like, we don't need Simone de Beauvoir. We don't need Betty Friedan. We got this all figured out. And it strikes me, it struck me then and it strikes me now, that every generation thinks it has figured this problem out, and then only for it to sort of rediscover the problem 20 years later. I think we keep seeing this over and over. You are so correct that so much has changed. And, you know, again, to go back just to quickly say about engineering at MIT, which was really a male bastion, there are 8 departments there. 5 of them are now led by women. That is astonishing. So that's great. But I do think the final hurdle here really is how we look at women and whether we take them as seriously as intellectual and professional. And I think that underlies the Me Too problem. I think it is all about, you know, how do we see people? I think we've gotten, you know, this was the MIT story was a very early case or very early example of what we now call unconscious bias. And I think that, you know, unconscious bias has become, we've talked about it so much now, 25 years later, that I think people kind of dismiss it and think like, oh yeah, I know what that is. I don't have it. I had the workplace training. But the reality is that it's really that simple. It's changing your mindset. It's changing how you look at people and recognizing that, yes, we're still not seeing women as equal. And I think until we get to that point, all of these problems are going to continue coming up in one way or another.
All right. Kate Zernike is a reporter for The New York Times, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, former reporter for The Boston Globe, and author now of The Exceptions. Kate, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much.